Welcome to Reboot with Dr. R.C. Maran, where we have real conversations that hopefully reconnects you to your health and to your power. I am your host, Dr. R.C. Maran, interventional cardiologist. This podcast is the result of my desire to take my message of health outside the cath lab and outside the hospital. Today, we are talking about a topic that so many of us struggle with, but a very few understand through the right lens. Weight, more specifically, how weight, visceral fat, and metabolic health are deeply connected to your heart health. Let's make it very clear, we are not chasing a certain size, but this is about how you can reset your mind, your metabolic health in a different way. To talk about this, we have a very special guest, Dr. Sarah Strombaugh. She is a family medicine physician and a diplomate of the American Board of Obesity Medicine. She graduated from the Creighton University School of Medicine and completed her residency at the University of Chicago. She started a primary care practice in Evanston, Illinois, before relocating to Charlottesville, Virginia, where she has her own private weight loss clinic. Through her clinic, she sees patients both virtually and in person and helps them to tackle obesity with science, empathy, and structure. She is also the host of an excellent podcast called Conquer Your Weight, where she breaks down the science of sustainable weight loss, mindset shifts, and evidence-based strategy for reclaiming your health. Her mission is very clear: to empower individuals and the medical community to treat obesity as the chronic medical condition that it is, and not as a moral failing and not as a cosmetic issue, but as a real reversible threat to your long-term well-being. So if you are someone who's been struggling silently or a healthcare professional trying to do better for your patients, this episode will change how you think about weight and reset your mind. So let's dive in. Sarah, thank you so much for joining. I appreciate you taking time to come and join us today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. This is my favorite thing to talk about and share more broadly. So I'm excited for your audience and for us to connect today.
Absolutely. So kind of tell me your journey. How did you get to obesity and weight loss? And, you know, how did your practice evolve to this?
Absolutely. So my journey goes back a long time into my childhood. I grew up in rural Illinois, and my family, my community, many people around me were struggling with weight. And I, in addressing that, decided, okay, I'm going to go into primary care, help to understand. And I felt really frustrated in entering even into residency, where I'd have patients asking me, hey, doc, how do I lose weight? And I didn't really feel like I had advice beyond eat less and move more, which is maybe the worst advice you can give, yet it's given all of the time to patients. And so it was during my residency training that I began studying obesity medicine, utilized all of my elective time throughout residency to train with physicians, both in adult and pediatric obesity, both in bariatric surgery and the medical piece of it throughout residency to be able to support my patients. And so I went into my first practice with part of my practice being dedicated to the treatment of weight, supporting patients both from a primary care standpoint and then also from a weight standpoint. And interestingly, we knew that we'd be moving after a few years. My husband is also in medicine and had been in training for a while. And we were looking at making a cross-country move. And I was having this challenge for myself of, you know, what will I do? Will I continue to work in this employed medicine role, which has many upsides, but had a lot of challenges as well? Or I had felt this calling to maybe work in private practice, whether that was on my own or with someone else. And so I had done a life coaching program actually as a participant, trying to figure out this answer for myself. And it ended up being all of these tools I was learning were so amazing also to support my patients. And so I started using it both in the weight, you know, perspective, but also across other health behaviors to support them. And it's been this amazing conglomeration of, as I pull in the medicine of weight loss, understanding metabolic health and obesity, pulling in that behavioral piece to understand why do we make the decisions that we do, and then ultimately decided this is where I need to go. And to open that private practice. So I've been here for the last couple of years and have a private practice where we support patients comprehensively, helping them to understand why they feel like they may be fighting against their body, why there have been long-term struggles, looking at the nutrition piece, the movement piece, other parts of their health, whether that's sleep, other medical conditions or treatments for those. And then how do we help support someone in the environment that they're in? Understanding why we make the decisions we do, what are the challenges and setbacks we have, and then how do we learn from those? And it has been just phenomenal to see the support that my patients have had, both in terms of their health, but honestly, in terms of so many aspects of their life.
Fantastic. I mean, this is the joy of being in medicine, right? Whatever, whether it's a heart blockage or obesity, as you see the patients evolve and see that aha moment in their eyes that, oh, this is a bigger problem and I need to kind of tackle it. That's amazing. I'm so glad you were able to navigate your pathway to this. So you touched up about this, you know, growing up in rural Virginia, one of the, you know, the stroke belts of the United States, etc. The stigma, the language, the emotional burden of obesity and in medicine and in society. How do you, you know, break the initial barrier with your patients?
Absolutely. So I think it's really interesting to look at the language that we use and how we think about our weight compared to other health conditions. And so I find that we have so much bias as a society that then becomes really internalized, and people internalize that bias and have shame or judgment upon themselves about struggling with their weight or needing support even. You know, a lot of times there's shame or judgment about, you know, choosing to move forward with getting support for weight. And so a lot of times we'll look at other conditions and think about what that means. You know, if you had high blood pressure, for example, it's a condition for one is on the inside of your body. Your next door neighbor, your coworker, your friends, they have no idea that you're struggling with high blood pressure. It's a condition that lives inside of you. And it's very common that people may have poorly controlled high blood pressure that requires 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 medications even to help support them. And that would be something for which there may be, of course, diet, lifestyle changes, other things that are incorporated. And we do that alongside medical intervention. And what, you know, which pieces of it takes, which medications it takes, it's between you, that's between your physician. You get to make this whole change comprehensively without other people knowing. When we compare that to weight, you know, we certainly want to be thinking about the lifestyle factors. And is there something in your system? Is there something metabolically that's going on that may be out of your control? Are there genetic factors, epigenetic factors? So how our genes relate to the environment that we're in or change because of the environment that we've been in, other environmental factors, things that we, you know, perimenopause, maybe things that we cannot control that we're fighting against. And so then we have this condition that unfortunately lives on the outside of our body, which may invite commentary from others or questions from others, but really helping to understand that no different than high blood pressure or asthma or cancer or any other health condition, this is something that you deserve that comprehensive support, which may include both medical care and maybe even surgical care, if it makes sense.
Absolutely. So what is your process when a patient comes to your clinic? How do you break that down? Do you start with the mindset portion or do you start with the medical side of it? What is your process?
Absolutely. So in our intake, we're looking at all of it. We're thinking about someone's entire medical history, including their weight history. It's really important to understand if someone has had weight loss attempts before, if they're actively trying to lose weight at this time and what they've done. We know that weight cycling, when someone has gained weight and lost weight and gained weight and lost weight, that can have impacts on our metabolic rate, can have impacts on our body fat mass or composition. So we're looking at all of these different factors. When we dive in from a treatment plan, I don't like to throw a million things at people at once because sometimes when someone says, hey, go do these 10 different things, we end up doing none of them. But I typically will start with both a behavioral piece as well as a medical piece. A lot of times by the time patients have come to my practice, most people are invested in a program. They've been working hard and trying to lose weight, and it's not been going as smoothly as they had hoped. And so by the time they're seeing me, typically they are working through some of those other pieces. So we'll dive in. Usually from the beginning, we're talking about prescriptions. Now, I don't require anyone in my practice to take medications. I believe very strongly the patient is the boss of their own body. They get to decide. If you don't want to, I support that completely as well. But most people have that interest, and that may be why they're seeking me out. But we do pull in that behavioral piece as well. Initially, we start having all of our patients do food logging. And so I have a program by which people are food logging. We actually do just a journal. So that can be a digital journal, like in the notes app of your phone. That could be a handwritten journal if that's someone's preference. But really, just understanding what time of day did you eat? What did you eat? You could put in some general things like saying, I have two eggs, but you don't have to weigh, you don't have to measure. We're not doing calorie counting or macro counting. And over time, we utilize that to pay attention to what is our hunger, what is our fullness, recognizing which foods will create that for us. And so if we eat protein, if we're eating fiber, how those may be more satiating and noticing, oh, isn't interesting. On the day when I had, two scrambled eggs and half of an avocado for breakfast, I felt really satiated for hours versus the day I had a blueberry muffin, and an hour later I was ravenous. So starting to pay attention to what are the food preferences we already have, what's already happening in your life, and then we really utilize that food log and journal to help track the hunger and satiety, other symptoms that they're having, maybe mood or situations that they're in. And it becomes a really fun way that we get a glimpse into what is going on. So at every visit, we're addressing that, we're reviewing that, looking back then at challenges that came up over the last month, looking forward, okay, over the next month, are there trips coming up? Are there special occasions? Are there things, obstacles that may come up that we should plan for in advance? So we try to do those two things in parallel, but in this sort of layered way. We can't do it all at the first
Of
visit.
course. I think the biggest thing is what you said, to be in tune to what is happening. Most of the time, people who are struggling with weight, myself included, there's this component of mindless eating. You're just eating because there is food and you're not in tune with your hunger cues or your thirst cues. And I think what you're doing right now is trying to connect, make people or your patients make that connection between food and hunger and thirst and hunger, and kind of be their own detective or something and figure out what's happening with their body. Am I correct about that?
That's exactly. And even with emotional eating or mindless eating, for example, putting in, if someone has a binge eating episode, or if they have, we'll talk about like the quantity of food that they consumed, for example, it is perfectly acceptable and probably the ideal way to log it if at 8 p.m. you had too much chocolate, if you
Yes.
found that you were just unwinding into the pantry,
Yes.
that recognizing what was going on at that time, what behavior resulted in that, it's so valuable to see that. And the value of reflecting it back with another person, like myself, like a health psychologist, maybe like a coach perhaps who's experienced in this area, is we get to work through that without judgment. And so it's so easy when we've had some sort of eating behavior that is outside of our desired behavior to approach that then with shame or with judgment, or I can't believe I did that. What was I thinking? I've been trying to lose weight. Why did I eat that food? Why did I eat so much of it? But instead, to take a step back and imagine if we were seeing this play out on a movie screen, if you were watching it in somebody else's life, and think about what is the impact of this? Okay, it happened. So what do we learn? Because you're going to find yourself in similar situations in the future. If you're feeling stressed out, if you're hungry because dinner was just an on-the-go option, if you are upset about something and turning to food, if you're bored and that's the emotion to which you're responding with food, how do we help support you? Because you're going to find yourself in a similar situation. And the good news is, if we use this as a learning opportunity, you get to find that success in the future.
Fantastic. I mean, because we are kind of caught into this psychological game of, oh, I screwed up tonight. I had too much chocolate, and therefore my whole diet is gone. My entire thing is gone. So there's no point continuing this process anymore. So let me eat more. So this all or nothing thinking,
Exactly.
which kind of, messes up. What are the tools you tell your patients to reset themselves if that happens.
Absolutely. So I, you know, when we look at what are the foods that are most in line with weight goals, there's certain foods, particularly sugar and flour, others as well, but those come up often as the most common triggers for people, the ones that may be really challenging, because they're likely to overeat them or have had experiences with overeating or mindlessly eating those foods. We know that simple carbohydrates do not create satiety in the same way, and so we can eat often even large quantity of those without feeling sometimes even physically ill, in the way that, you know, if you were full, you would never sit down and eat a chicken breast. Your body would be like, oh, like that sounds
Terrible.
revolting to have any more protein in my body right now. But a simple carbohydrate, we can almost always stomach, you know, a little bit more simple carbohydrate. And so I say that to say, you know, when we're thinking about this all or nothing thinking, we know that having sugar, we know that having flour, that those are not going to be in line with most of our health goals. But the challenge is, and where I find a lot of diet programs or nutrition plans really make a mistake, is they tell patients just to not have any of those. And this is, it creates that all or nothing thinking. So all of a sudden, that food is off limits. It gets put almost on a platform of there's something special. We don't, our brains turn into little children. It's like, well, if you tell me I can't have that thing, that I want to have that thing, and I'm thinking about it more and obsessing about it more. And so I actually really encourage my patients to find an amount of that food that they can enjoy. And if you had, you know, let's say it is chocolate, for example, how many days per week, if you looked at a typical week, for example, how many days would you like to say, I ate chocolate this number of days, and feel both proud of that decision that, you know, maybe it wasn't every single day or multiple times per day, but then also a decision that's in line with your goals? Because for most people, they can probably eat chocolate. It may be every single day in a small quantity, or it may be a handful of times per week where they can sit down, they can savor it, they can really enjoy it, and find that they're still moving in the direction of their ultimate health goals. They're still losing weight, they're improving their mindset with food. And let's say over 7 days, you're like, you know what, I'd like to have chocolate 3 times, for example. What can happen is when we set the goal of having chocolate 3 times, at the end of the week, let's say you've had chocolate 3 times, you can either be in line with your goals, feel good about yourself, reestablish that relationship with yourself that I am the type of person who does what I say I'm going to do, or you can be the type of person who says, I'm never going to eat chocolate. You have chocolate one time and you're beating yourself up and really breaking down that relationship with yourself. So that intentional planning in advance, the intentional enjoyment of it, like if you're going to eat the food, you might as well enjoy it. You know, if you're going to consume it anyway, savor it, let it melt in your mouth, enjoy the flavor, and establish that and build that relationship with yourself.
So, that resonates so much with me because I'm such a chocolate addict and I have tried all the methods. And finally, the savoring method was too much. There was too much mind chatter about the day I'm going to eat chocolate. So I realized I cannot put chocolate in such a pedestal where I just get it. There was the scarcity mentality working towards chocolate and it was eating me up. So now after every meal, I have a teeny tiny piece of chocolate and chocolate is off the thing. The mental chatter just went away. So just figuring out, trying with being, giving yourself grace, trying different methods and figuring out what works for you. And I mean, it's so good to have a support system like what you are providing to your patients to have that. Otherwise, it becomes a very difficult struggle for sure.
Absolutely.
So, we are in the world of medications, which can help us lose weight. It's somehow like I kind of think of medications almost like what ChatGPT and of weight loss or something, right? Like how there are parents who think my kid is going to forget what it is to learn because of ChatGPT. I think there's a group of people who think just because there are GLP-1 medications and other medications for weight loss, patients and human beings are going to lose their ability to have willpower or something like that. What do you, how do you navigate this? How do you remove the shame from it's okay to take the help of science to help you with the medical problem you have.
Absolutely. Well, I think one of the most important things in the conversation that we were having earlier of weight being a condition we wear on the outside of our body, just because it's a condition we wear on the outside of our body does not mean that we have to share every detail of our weight and health journey with people who ask. And so, for one, I think there's a lot of fear of judgment of others. What would my friend think? What would my mom think? What would my coworker think? And I'm going to tell you, they don't have to think about it because they don't have to know. And so, in the way that any other health condition is private, I will encourage my patients, who knows that you're taking this blood pressure medication or this antidepressant medication? If people in your life, you feel comfortable sharing that level of medical detail with them, you could, if you desire, share this level of medical detail about your health and weight journey if you want to, but you absolutely do not have to. So, for one, when we're afraid of the judgment of others, we can let that piece go in deciding that it's not their business and we don't need to tell them. When we think about, though, that decision for ourselves, when we think about that internalized bias, there is a lot of times this question of, is it cheating? Am I jumping to this medication too early? Will this mean, right, that I've lost my willpower, for example? And it's really worth exploring what is going on. For someone in my practice right now, I have never encountered a patient who comes to me and is like, oh, actually, I eat McDonald's for every meal, and I'm, have donuts at the office 5 times a week, and I'm, making all of these like traditionally like unhealthy choices. The patients who are coming to me are generally eating incredibly well, sometimes meals that would be worthy of posting on Instagram. They may be eating lean proteins and vegetables and struggling at times with cravings for food and emotional relationship with food, and finding at times that they're overeating, sometimes even healthy foods. It's possible to overeat any food, whether it's a traditionally healthy food or a traditionally unhealthy food. Struggling with a relationship of, when do I start a meal? When is my body feeling hungry? When do I choose to end a meal? It's very common to overeat either because we're just not thinking about it, we're used to eating a portion that's been set down in front of us rather than paying attention to where we would naturally end the meal if it was left to our own devices. So we find that a lot of times patients are doing many of the things, and yet they're still struggling with their weight goals. And it's because we look at this underlying metabolic disease. And when we think about metabolic disease, it's a spectrum of usually insulin resistance, where the body over time, the earliest signs of it may be changes on labs, early signs of insulin resistance, maybe the beginnings of weight and weight gain, particularly central weight gain around our midsection or our abdomen. But then we also see exactly that visceral fat. We see that progress sometimes to prediabetes or even type 2 diabetes. And it's really the same spectrum of condition, these underlying insulin resistant conditions. You'll see it show up in other labs, oftentimes in our cholesterol labs, particularly the LDL and triglycerides, although you may see it in terms of a low HDL as well. You may see it in your liver enzyme labs in gaining weight, but also in our waist circumference and that gaining of central weight or visceral fat, as we were talking about. So there's this underlying metabolic resistance that once our body has, can be really challenging to reverse with diet and exercise alone. Now, certainly diet and exercise, depending on how long you've had metabolic disease, how significantly you've struggled with it, diet and exercise work and can be helpful and should be used as part of the journey. But when those alone are not sufficient, layering on medications like the GLPs is absolutely life-changing for people, in that all of the decisions they've been wanting to make, that they've been trying to make, they feel like they're able to make those and be in line with their goals in a way that before medication, they may not have been able to do.
So, do you struggle in your practice with patients who come and say, I have a wedding to get to, put me on GLP-1, let me lose weight? I mean, do you struggle with those kind of patients? How do you deal with that?
And not necessarily wanting to make some of the changes alongside of it, you mean?
Yes, none of the mindset changes, just the weight loss changes, like thinking of GLP-1s as a summer crash dieting thing, which I'm sure you're not encouraging patients to do that.
Right. No, exactly. So I think there's a lot of conversation around that right now, and using it in a short-term way, let me maybe take it for 2, 3, 4 months, lose the weight, and then I'll stop the medication. And we know when the medication's used in that way that it tends to have rebound weight. You know, if that is your sole way in which you're utilizing the medication without making the other changes, it's just going to be another failed diet in your long list of probably failed diets in the past. And so if someone is really interested and excited about starting a medication, we'll talk about the other pieces. And I almost never withhold the medication. I certainly would if there was someone who was speaking about it, maybe with an eating disorder mindset, for example, and their head was not, you know, they weren't willing or open to making the other changes. But even if they've sort of, you know, slipped off the wagon, as it were, they feel like they've not been as in line with their goals. Sometimes starting the GLP is the medication that helps them get back on track with things. And so we're talking about how I like to use the medication, what it's intended for in terms of the length of use of medication. You know, people who say, oh, I want to use it for 3 months or 6 months. I've had patients who've used it for temporary uses of time, like 12 to 24 months. I have never had somebody who successfully in 3 months has used and stopped the medication. It's not in line with how I
That's
prescribe
good.
it.
That's
I
good.
think they'd probably turn and run the other direction if I.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, we hear about GLP-1. So I have so many patients. Obviously, they're all heart patients, and at least more than half of them struggle with obesity. Okay, they are struggling with obesity, and when I in my clinic visits, I talk about diet and exercise, and I talk about GLP-1. Some of them have a very adverse reaction towards it. I don't want to give up on food. This intense relationship with food is, so high that they don't want to give up their relationship with food. So it's almost like, I look at them and they'll be with their spouse. I'm like, I'm not asking you to break your relationship with your spouse, but you are having such a kind of very aggressive reaction to what I'm saying. Do you realize what an intense relationship you have? And this medication can help you soften that breakup almost. And can you think about it? And the next, immediately they bring what they talk about is, oh, this medication has so many side effects. I'm going to lose all my muscle. I'm not going to be able to enjoy life at all. And if I stop, I'm going to put on all the weight. And I'm like, let's talk about the side effects of the disease you're having right now. And the side effects of the disease right now outweighs the side effects you will have from these medications. What is the conversation you have with your patients to kind of say it's okay, or these medicines are safe enough?
Absolutely. So when we look at the safety of these medications, we have really good safety data of the GLP medications. So while they're being used for the treatment of weight and metabolic disease at this time, they go back in the treatment of metabolic disease in the form of type 2 diabetes to the very early 2000s. So Byetta was the first FDA-approved medication or first FDA-approved GLP medication for the treatment of type 2 diabetes in 2005. So those early clinical trials were starting in the early 2000s. So we have at least 2 decades, probably about 2.5 decades, really, of safety data from these medications. So when we think about the safety of, is it safe to take this new medication for long term? I feel really good about that as a choice. When we look at the risk of cancers, for example, you know, there's sometimes some fear mongering of, oh, it'll increase the risk of thyroid cancer, which interestingly has not proven to be the case at all. What we do know is that treating obesity or reducing weight reduces the risk of many different types of cancers,
Absolutely.
colon cancer, breast cancers, prostate cancer. There's many of them. We see reductions across many different types of cancers. So there's this, as you're saying, the health conditions that you're living with right now, the consequences of those are known, maybe very significant, life-threatening, completely. And when we look at the side effects of the GLP medications, I think there's a lot that can be done to really decrease those. So when we look at the dosing, whether we're talking about Wegovy, whether we're talking about Zepbound, or any of the other medications, these medications are designed to be started at a low dose of medication. Interestingly, I've had a couple of patients recently who said, "Oh, I'm someone who needs higher doses of all the medications I'm on. Can I just start at a high dose of this medication?" I'm like, "You really, really do not want to. I'm not going to prescribe it in that way." And so, and I've heard some stories actually of people being prescribed intermediate or high doses of these medications, which absolutely should not be done. So everybody, regardless of their size, regardless of their medical history, everybody should be started on the introductory dose of medication. I guess the only exception to that is if you're switching from one GLP medication to another GLP medication. But everybody is starting out at the starting dose of medication. And then when I think about the titration, I generally take it pretty slow in my practice. When we look at the clinical trials, they started at the introductory dose, and then every 4 weeks, the dose was titrated to the next dose. For Wegovy, they were studying the top dose of medication, the 2.4 milligram dose. For Zepbound, they did study three doses, the 5 milligram, the 10 milligram, and the 15 milligram as three different treatment doses of medication. But whether we're talking about either of those two medications, the one thing I feel very strongly about in my practice is that depending on the side effects that a person's having, how it's feeling in their body, as well as then the effectiveness, and are they effectively losing weight and seeing the scale gains or losses that we would expect them to see? Those are the two decisions that I will use in moving up a dose. And so it's very common in my practices that I may have patients on what are considered titration doses of medication. I may have them on those titration doses for longer periods of time, if either from a side effect standpoint, they're having really significant side effects, or in terms of a weight perspective, if they're just seeing significant losses on the scale, is there any reason that we need to move them quickly to that next dose of medication? And I would argue no. But of course, it's going to be a really individualized conversation to have with their physician. When we look at the side effects that come up of these medications, they're primarily GI, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, but most of them are mild. Most of them will decrease over time. Most of them can be very well managed. And as long as their prescriber is talking to them about the risk of these, nausea, for example, certain foods are going to make that worse. So overeating, which I put in air quotes, because you may find that you hit fullness very early on these medications. And even if it's a small quantity of food that creates that feeling of, oh my gosh, I ate too much, it's really important to stop when you feel that, oh wow, I'm feeling full. Fatty foods, we think of sort of the unhealthy fats like a cheeseburger and fries or pizza or chicken tenders or that type of thing. But even healthy fats, if you had a meal that was a salmon and maybe there was a vinaigrette in a meal and maybe avocados or other, if you had a lot of healthy fats in a meal, that is also going to sit really heavily in the stomach and can create side effects. So too fatty of meals can really be bothersome. So counseling patients about those pieces, for example, can actually help to decrease side effects really significantly. Constipation, very, very common. I've never had a patient who's had to discontinue the medication because of constipation. When we look at some of the risk of bowel obstruction, for example, which can be the case of almost severe constipation, I have had, I've not had any patients who've had bowel obstruction. And when we think about that and some of the clinical studies that I've seen with other patients, a lot of it may have come up because of poorly managed constipation that came up early on. So can we be thinking about fiber as a supplement, magnesium, maybe Miralax or Senna if you need additional support? Every single one of the patients in my practice who's had something like constipation come up has been able to manage it very effectively with one or more medications over the counter for the support of it. And so most of the side effects that come up can be very well managed. And when we look at the long-term safety, I feel very confident about what this is, especially compared to what is oftentimes many known disease processes that we can maybe reverse with the GLPs.
I mean, I've had patients who, what I do in my practice right now is I will start them on a GLP-1, and my note is almost half a page long, justifying why this patient with known heart disease and struggling with high blood pressure and arthritis and obstructive sleep apnea, lung disease, and also blockages in the blood vessels of the heart need to be on GLP-1. I'll put them on the introductory dose and send that note to their primary care physician and have them titrate. And funnily enough, if that process goes seamlessly, that is, insurance covers, the primary care physician buys in and escalates the dose appropriately, they'll come back to me in 3 to 4 months and be like, I think we need to come down on blood pressure medications because I'm dizzy and extra, and I'm peeling off blood pressure medications. Sometimes even they would be on three medicines and now they'd be on no medications, which is a big big change for them. And I'm even bringing down their statin medication dosage from a 40 of rosuvastatin. I'm like, I think we can just come to 10 or even 5. And, you know, it's so much reduction in medication. It's truly nice that there is finally something we can offer to them. Yes, there is no free lunch. There are some side effects, but I think which are manageable, etc. But one question which I probably don't deal with it, so I would love to hear your thoughts on. Can you successfully wean yourself off GLP-1s?
That is a great question. And I get this question all the time, as you can imagine. I actually just recorded a podcast episode for myself. I think it's going live probably end of July, beginning of August. And so that will be something to listen to as well. The short answer is it depends. So generally, these medications are designed for long-term use. And when we look at the safety and how they were designed to be used, they are designed to be used in that fashion. I think the question is also, what is the underlying disease process that they're treating, and how significant, both in quantity as well as how long-standing, has that metabolic disease been present? And when it's something that's been shorter term, so someone who has maybe struggled with their weight and has fewer weight-related comorbidities, so they may not have high blood pressure or hyperlipidemia, they may not have prediabetes or diabetes, they may just have maybe one of those, or they've only been struggling with their weight for the last 2 to 5 years, I find that there are some patients for whom we take a very gradual titration. They may respond, for one, at low doses of medications, so we're not unnecessarily titrating them beyond where they're having effective medication. And then I've had patients for whom they're achieving their weight goals and to the point where coming completely to a normal, a BMI in the range of 22 or 23. And it's like, wow, we've resolved other comorbid conditions and you do not need to continue to lose weight for any reason. And, you know, of course they agree with me. And so sometimes we're reducing the dose of medication in response to that. So we're saying, hey, on this dose of medication that you're on, you know, I've had patients that are losing weight beyond their goals, so we can decrease them on their dose. Sometimes we're spacing them out on their dose. If a patient is interested in weaning off of a medication, that conversation often looks different compared to if they're not interested in weaning off of the medication or seeing the effects of it. I think one of the things that's really interesting is that starting out, many people, as we talked about before, are reluctant to go on the medication. Mm-hmm. But then they start and they see they have decreased cravings for sugar. They may see it in other areas of their life, like decreased cravings for alcohol comes up very frequently in my patients. And all of a sudden they're like, I want to feel this way the rest of my life. I don't ever want to not have this medication in my body. I'd love to have it always in there in some extent. And so there are patients for whom we're able to wean off. There's patients for whom, you know, I have patients who take a low dose of medication every other week, for example. That is not certainly standard of care to do that, but there are patients for whom it supports their weight goals to be able to take it in that way. But what's true for people who've been struggling with their weight for longer periods of time, who have more significant metabolic disease, whether that is prediabetes and diabetes, whether that is heart disease, whether that is other conditions that they're dealing with, as well as how much excess weight they've had on their body and for how long they've had it, it's very common that we are thinking about long-term use of these medications. Mm-hmm. So there was a really interesting study that came out of Denmark. And so as you know, Novo Nordisk, the company that makes Ozempic and Wegovy, is based in Denmark. It's kind of wild. These medications, the semaglutide medications, have changed the entire country. I mean, the GDP of the country, some huge percent of it is made up from, you know, the profits of these medications. Uh-huh. But I say that to say there's some really fascinating studies coming out of Denmark. Denmark is like, let's do all of the studies. We'll study it in pregnant women. We'll study it in weaning the medication. They're doing some really fascinating things that, you know, because of ethical and maybe other reasons, we won't get approval to be able to do in America.
Yeah.
But they had a study that was released last year in 2024 that looked at what happens, you know, can you wean people off of medication? And there were two parts of the study, one where they had patients titrate their dose really slowly and take a sort of customized approach to their dosing. So I have to imagine they were using Ozempic pens perhaps to do that. But they had patients take intermediate doses, so actually even microdosing. So they started them at the traditional 0.25, which is the regular starting dose of either Ozempic or Wegovy medication, as you know. But then they would have them take intermediate doses and choose the dose that was helping support them in their goal. So, at the end of the study, on average, patients were taking 0.77 milligrams of medication, which is about a third of the maximum dose of medication, which is really fascinating. And then, depending if patients were achieving their weight goals, they gave them the option to wean off of the medication. So, interestingly, only about 15% of the 2,000 patients in the trial, about like 300 and change, I forget the exact number, but 350 or so, were weaned off of the medication. 200 and some of those patients did successfully wean all the way off of medication. And what's interesting is that on average, those patients lost an additional, I think it was 1.5% of their total body weight. And so there were patients for whom that was the case, but we're talking about kind of reviewing the numbers. About 2,000 people in the trial, 350-ish of them were attempted to wean off the medications because of patient factors where they had lost adequate weight, their other comorbidities were improving. And then about two-thirds of those patients, I think 240 some, actually successfully weaned off of medication. So it was about 10% of the total patients that started the trial that did successfully wean off medication and actually did really well. And their wean was over 9 weeks. So actually not a huge length of time as far as I'm concerned. If when we've done weans, a lot of times they've happened over like 6 months, they've happened over very long periods of time or even longer. But I say that to say, it's absolutely possible, but it's going to be a small subset of the population, and it's going to be dependent on how much weight, how much other metabolic disease is going on, how long those conditions have been going on, as well as there's other patient factors that may be unpredictable to us until you have the patient in front of you.
Even though I've asked you the question as we are discussing this, I'm almost like, why should we even think of weaning them off off this medication? If I start a patient on high blood pressure, for example, lisinopril controls the blood pressure and their blood pressure is back in the normal range. I never talk about weaning off lisinopril. Ever. I literally tell them, you're going to be in lisinopril. It's working really well. There's no side effects. We are going to continue in this dose for the rest of your life. So, but look at us, even though we don't want this associated shame or anything, but we think of weight loss medication as almost like makeup, like, oh, let's wear it to look good or for this. And now it's achieved its goals and let's wash it off. And I think the framework should change that. Obesity is a chronic disease, and there are multiple emotional, physiological factors that make a human to go to that weight. And if there is a medication which has helped you conquer all those, the psychological factors or physiological factors, I think, we should encourage patients to keep that, because the dangers of weight cycling is way more than being on a single medication at a lower dose, or the least or the max tolerated dose, or the least tolerated dose is much more beneficial physiologically, don't you think?
Oh, 100%. I agree with everything that you said. And I think it's really good to clarify that because as we think about really any other health condition, if someone has high blood pressure, right, and we're treating them with lisinopril and their blood pressure comes down now into a textbook perfect range, we don't call that person, not hypertensive. We say this person has well-controlled hypertension. And so we run into struggles even like with insurance companies, for example, where it's like, oh, the patient's reached reached their goal weight, so they no longer have obesity, they don't need these medications. And it's like, wait. The reason that is because of these medications. And so, it's interesting, like when I think about doing my own podcast episode, for example, I don't know how many podcast episodes I have, like 130 probably, like there's 140, I don't know. There are so many, I've been at this for almost 3 years in doing the podcast, and it has taken until I literally just recorded it the other day. It has taken until this week for me to actually record that episode because my belief system is exactly what you said. Why would we stop a medication that is working for you? And I also want to fairly answer the question because there are people who are wondering that and who maybe are losing weight beyond what their goals are, for example, and do not need the medication at as high of a dose, for example. And what happens if we stop the medication? And so, yes, 100%. If it's supporting your goals, you should stay on it. And we do have some data that there may be a small subset of people for whom the long-term use of it may not make sense or may not be required.
Absolutely. So the bottom line is this is a very personalized approach, and you have to, definitely seek the advice and guidance of a healthcare professional to deal with this. And obesity, like any other chronic disease, is a disease problem and needs a healthcare professional. It's not that you can just go and talk to random people. And sometimes, it's like it's like hypertension or high cholesterol or the cancer. How many breast cancer patients are now on chronic suppressive therapy for the rest of their life? We don't ever, and those chemotherapy medications have way more side effects than GLP-1s, but we still continue that. And how many cancers are caused by visceral obesity itself? So I think we should change that mind shift completely.
Well, and I'll add to that. I think one of the things as a patient to be really mindful of the physician and other providers who are in your life, because unfortunately, obesity bias even comes up in the healthcare space. And when we think about weaning off of medication, for example, as I said, I believe very strongly that the patient is the boss of their body, and I'll partner with them if that is patient driven to see, hey, is this something that makes sense for your journey? What I see happening a lot, and patients will reach out to us sometimes on social media with different stories that have happened to them, is their physician or another healthcare provider will be the one driving, like, oh, you've lost the weight. It's time to stop the medication. Or as they may be willing to prescribe GLP or other weight support medication, but don't necessarily have comprehensive support or still are using language that can be really negative and really biased. And so, if you find yourself in a position where you're not getting the support that you need, or you're being driven to make a decision that doesn't align with what we're talking about right now, you feel uncomfortable, like, wait, why do I have to stop the medication? I want to keep taking it. I would recommend to see someone who is certified in obesity medicine, who studied this, who's going to be able to support you in that long-term way without making you feel any shame or bias in the healthcare space.
Fantastic. So, Sarah, we are coming to the end of our podcast here. If there are three practical things you can tell someone who is trying to reset their relationship with weight, what would they be?
Absolutely. Oh my goodness. I can't have 10. I have to choose three. Working with an obesity medicine physician is such a valuable tool. And so, if you are someone who has struggled with your weight in a chronic way, feeling really stuck and frustrated, there are solutions. Even if you've lost weight and gained weight in the past and you feel like nothing is going to work for me, there are absolutely solutions and people who are highly trained in this area to support you. I would encourage people to look for physicians in their area who are obesity medicine trained. You can do that on the ABOM website, the American Board of Obesity Medicine. They have a physician finder tool, which can be a great way. You can put in your zip code, look for someone who is near you. So certainly that can be one option. And for you to feel comfortable in your space. So as I was saying, that when you go in to speak with your physician, that you feel like someone is listening to you, is taking your consideration, is providing advice or guidance about these other areas, or at least directing you to places where you can get that additional advice or guidance. I think having those levels of support is really important. The other piece is that the mindset piece is invaluable and is really the crux of we can fix the underlying metabolic piece. We can feed you the world's best food and move in certain ways. And the relationship that we have with ourselves, the relationship that we have with food is so powerful. Looking at if you recognize, oh gosh, I really don't have the relationship with food that I desire to, working with a coach, working with a health psychologist, working with someone who has understanding and practice in that space is going to be one of the most valuable tools to help to really overcome that relationship, understand that relationship, and start moving forward in a way that feels more neutral, more informative, rather than this kind of roller coaster of emotions we can often feel during a weight journey.
Fantastic, fantastic. All right, Dr. Sarah Strombo, thank you so much. This conversation was rich with honesty, evidence, and truly empathy. So, for the audience, if you're listening to this and you feel like this weight has always been a battle for you, I hope you are reminded that you are not broken, you are not lazy, you are a beautifully, perfectly imperfect human being, and change is possible. The side effects of untreated obesity is way higher than the side effects of the solutions that we have right now. So, to hear more of Dr. Sarah's insight, please go and follow her podcast, Conquer Your Weight. It's packed with real talk, science, and stories you'll all relate to. And if you've loved today's conversation, please share it with someone you love, and maybe this is what they need to reboot their life. Until then, I'll catch you with the next episode. Goodbye.